And a Radio Derb is on the air. Yes, this is your unctuously genial host, John Derbyshire, with this week's survey of the world's fads, follies, frauds, and floxy-norsy-nihilipifilications, brought to you courtesy of Tacky's Magazine. It's been rather a special week here on the island, listeners. Tacky's yacht moored off the island yesterday, and Tacky himself came ashore and enjoyed our overnight hospitality. Before he left this morning, I asked him if he would say a few words of greeting to our listeners, and he graciously agreed to do so. Here, then, is the voice of our esteemed proprietor, Tacky Theodorakopoulos. I apologise for the extraneous background noise. Tacky's address was recorded this morning over a farewell brunch at Nicky Nicolaides' Goat Burger joint. Tacky, may I prevail upon you to say a few words of greeting to Radio Derb listeners?
Of course. God bless you all for tuning in and for helping to support this fine institution. I know that Radio Derb, intensively researched and spotlessly unbiased reporting, can only advance the process of truth, justice, and world peace, plus my hangover of tomorrow. I'd also like to thank the very professional staff of Radio Derb for all their efforts, especially the female staff, especially John's charming young research assistant who helped me to erect my apparatus last night.
Yes, if I may, Tacky, I should just explain that Tacky is a fitness enthusiast and brings a modest home gym with him wherever he goes. He likes to have a strenuous workout before turning in for the night.
Just so. Which reminds me, it would be nice in future visits if some of you young ladies would lie underneath me while I do the push-ups. It helps me go faster. In conclusion, though, I'd like to say to John and all the staff of Radio Derb, you're all doing very well. Now, if you'll excuse me, I must take my leave.
Of course. Thank you so much, Tacky. Be careful. I am glad to say that no lasting harm was done there. Nicky has been compensated for the breakages, and Tacky is safely back on his yacht. What an honour it was to be visited by our proprietor himself. We all wish Tacky good health and long life. Now to the week's news. Some listeners have emailed in to ask why Radio Derb hasn't said more about the great Washington DC power battle over the national debt. Short answer, because it isn't really news. If you take the S off the end of the word news, you're left with new. That's the essence of news. It's something that's come up that hasn't come up before. That doesn't really apply to the debt crisis. It's come up before, and it'll come up again. Remember the budget crisis of mid-2011? And the fiscal cliff drama back in January this year? Well, here we were again this week, at the cliff edge. And here we shall be again in a few months' time. In fact, we know to the precise day, hour, minute and second when we'll be here again, at the stroke of midnight on February 7th next year. That's when the deal struck on Wednesday this week for the debt ceiling expires. The deal also reopens those parts of the federal government that shut down, but they'll get shut down again January 15th, so there'll be a little mini-crisis there. In other words, Congress and the President just kicked the can down the road. That's not just me saying that. For my amusement, I just went to Google News and put the two phrases debt limit and kick the can into the search box. About 4,570 results, said Google. scanning the news sources they listed, a lot of heavyweight commentators are there. The Wall Street Journal, Market Watch, Bloomberg, Time Magazine, all the TV networks, Weekly World News. Wait a minute, how did that one get in there? No, never mind. You can take it from me or from one of the other 4,569 news outlets. The fiscal can has been kicked down the political road. Why would you expect anything else? That's what our politicians do. They kick the can down the road. They are grasshoppers, not ants. They have no thought for the morrow. They just want to be able to do tomorrow what they did today. Spend money. Our government is just a spending machine, a machine for ever-increasing spending. You often hear citizens say, I wish they'd cut out all the bickering and rancour and just get on with running the country. Well, I don't actually agree with that. There are honest differences of opinion about national affairs, and bickering and rancour are how those differences get aired and discussed. If you want a system of government with no bickering or rancour, move to North Korea. There are, though, basic functions we entrust to the government that we expect them to take care of with a minimum of drama and disagreement. There is, for example, providing for the national defence and safeguarding the borders. And then there is maintaining the nation's fiscal integrity, warding off evils like hyperinflation or massive bank failures. National defence and border security I'll talk about elsewhere. Let's concentrate on the fiscal issue. Why can't our government manage the nation's finances better than this? Because to do so would impede their lust to spend. That's why. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the United States of Government Spending. All right, children, pay attention. Stop fidgeting, you in the back there. Now, can anyone tell me what Bowles Simpson was? Anyone? Bowles Simpson. Anyone remember that? Yes, young lady over there. That's right, Candy. Bowles Simpson was a plan to stabilize the fiscal system and put an end to these recurring crises. There was a committee, formerly the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, with 18 members, led by Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles. 12 of the members were Congress critters, 6 from each party. The others were business and union types, or pastured out old political war horses like Simpson and Bowles. They ruminated through most of 2010, and that December, that is 3 years ago, they put out a report. It proposed to reduce the national debt by $4 trillion and aimed to bring it to zero in 25 years. Plenty of people disliked Bowles Simpson, but that's what you'd expect. Government spending's out of control because lots of people want the money. To get the fiscal situation under control, you have to curb spending. Then, those people aren't getting their money, and of course they will howl. Bowles Simpson was a good faith plan to stabilise our national finances. After a cursory glance at the Commission's report, the people who run our country decided they'd rather go on spending like drunken sailors, even if it meant us lurching from crisis to crisis. So they deep-sixed the report. It was never put to a vote in Congress. President Obama, who'd appointed the Commission in a spirit of perfect cynicism, early in 2010, just to get the fiscal issue out of the way for the midterm election season, seems never to have paid the slightest attention to its recommendations. And so here we are, lurching from crisis to crisis. There's nothing much partisan here. Republicans and Democrats have both been criminally irresponsible with the national fisc. George W. Bush had complete control of Congress for 4 of his 8 years, and control of the House for 2 more. But he and his party spent money like lottery winners on crack. And yes, they ran up huge deficits and raised the debt ceiling. The problem is not partisan, it's systemic. What about the Tea Party, I hear you cry. They organised and took a stand, didn't they? And got representatives elected? And drove this recent effort to hold the debt ceiling hostage to the defunding of Obamacare? Yes, so they did. Let's take a look at the Tea Party. You can count me sympathetic to the Tea Party. I think they're a good thing. If nothing else, the poisonous hatred that the left displays towards them, the filthy and scurrilous language they use when talking about them, tells a patriotic conservative which side he's on here. Sure, these are honest people with the good of the country at heart. Let's remember, though, that the Tea Party is not a new phenomenon, only the new manifestation of an old one. The late Sam Francis wrote an essay titled Message from Mars, with capital M, capital A, and capital R. The Mars, the M-A-Rs, were middle American radicals. Ordinary citizens fed up with the country's leftward drift and willing to organise and vote to end it. That essay was written in 1982. Sam's middle American radicals were the ones who brought Ronald Reagan to power. There was another false dawn in the 1994 midterms when Newt Gingrich and his peasants with pitchforks broke through the walls of the establishment citadel and installed themselves in Congress. Bill Clinton and his congressional allies were soon running rings round them, with the help of the mass media, of course, just as Barack Obama and his minions ran rings around Ted Cruz and his insurgents this week. The Mars of the Reagan era, the Gingrich insurgents, now the Tea Party. The tide comes in, the tide goes out. Here's a thing I wrote for the American Conservative in spring of 2010, when the Tea Party movement was just gathering strength. Long quote from me. Our intellectuals also overestimated the economic radicalism of the Mars, projecting their own cherished abstractions onto citizens who, however aggrieved they might feel about government's grosser impositions, had no wish to let go of their Social Security, Medicare, public school and state college establishments, or the patriotic satisfactions of having the world's largest and best equipped military. Political activism by new groups, in any case, follows a parabolic trajectory. It is a fundamental truth of politics in open societies that any person likely to give significant time to politics already does so by early adulthood. A contentious local issue may fill your high school auditorium with angry citizens for an evening or two, but people will soon lose interest and drift away. Political activism is the enduring enthusiasm of a very few, like contract bridge. Perhaps it is just as simple as this. A meritocratic elite is, by definition, smarter than the rest of us. It can always control the discourse planting shame and doubt in the minds of those who seek to challenge it, manipulating their sensibilities, feeding them a steady diet of soma through media and educational outlets, bewildering and outfoxing them with bogus appeals to the higher emotions. Perhaps it is all an unequal contest. End quote. I don't think I'd take a word of that back. Hey, don't come to Radio Derb for cockeyed optimism. If you know anything about card tricks, conjuring, or even pickpocketing, you know that there is a science of attention. Of attention and distraction. You could almost think Barack Obama is a master of these dark arts. Look, while the whole country was distracted by this debt ceiling fight, Obamacare went through the first, most critical stage of its rollout to the public. It was a fiasco, but nobody noticed. We were all distracted by the shenanigans in Congress. Never let a serious crisis go to waste, said one of Obama's shills. It's an operating principle with these guys. Now, with all the energy drained out of Ted Cruz and his Tea Party battalion by this fight, now comes the push to amnesty illegal aliens and open up the country to a new flood of legal immigrants. This is the big one, the one that really matters, both to the Democrats seeking to destroy the traditional WASP America that they hate so much, and also to the Republican establishment, their pockets all stuffed with cash from billionaire donors clamouring for cheap labour. Quote from the Washington Post, October 16th, quote, President Obama, fresh off a trouncing of congressional Republicans over the government shutdown, plans to renew his push for immigration legislation in the House, while also pressing ahead with climate change policies and efforts to fix problems plaguing his signature health care program. End quote. Here's another quote from the Daily Mail Online, October 17th. This is Barack Obama talking about the Gang of Eight immigration bill to a Spanish-language TV station on Tuesday this week. Quote, we had a very strong Democratic and Republican vote in the Senate. The only thing right now that's holding it back is, again, Speaker Boehner not willing to call the bill on the floor of the House of Representatives. So we're going to have to get through this crisis that was unnecessary, that was created because of the obsession of a small faction of the Republican Party on the Affordable Care Act. Once that's done, you know, the day after, I'm going to be pushing to say, call a vote on immigration reform. End quote. So for his next conjuring trick, Obama the Magnificent will steer the stupid party into yet another government shutdown crisis early in the new year, followed at once by another debt ceiling crisis. And while we're all paying attention to the developments on those, he'll be picking our pockets on Obamacare again, and this time on immigration too. Look, Obamacare is a horrible mess, ramping up costs, adding new layers of bureaucracy, and transferring yet more wealth from the middle classes to the elites and their underclass allies. Classic class conflict, the top and the bottom united against the middle. Obama's plans on immigration are the real nation killer, though. Legalising 12 to 20 million foreign scofflaws and opening wide the doors to 30 or 50 million more. My colleague Peter Brimelow calls it treason. I've been reluctant to take up that word in the immigration context. It seemed hyperbolic to me. I'm coming to think it's correct, though. Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates claim that in a nation of 300 million, which spends more per capita on education than any other country in the world, they can't find computer programmers to staff their cubes. I say they're lying. They want cheap foreign labour to maximise their profits. They want to shut out American workers. It's treason. Agribusiness claims that crops are rotting in the fields because they can't get Americans to harvest them. Here's what I say to that. If a farmer can't run his business within the law, if he can't harvest his crops without flouting the people's laws passed by the people's representatives in Congress, then let him go out of business. And damn good riddance to him. In fact, let the bastard go to jail. He's committing treason. Barack Obama told a Chambers of Commerce gathering on September 18th that converting illegal aliens into citizens will, quote, add potentially $1 trillion to our economy. Let's imagine that's true, just for the sake of some arithmetic here. It's been a settled opinion among labour economists for 20 years that, in a modern welfare state economy, the only people who benefit from immigration are the immigrants. It does nothing for the native born. Okay, let's test that with Obama's potentially $1 trillion. The Center for Immigration Studies has projected that the Gang of Eight bill, once passed, would add 17.3 million new legal voting age US residents to the population by 2036. Let's suppose that those 17.3 million do indeed, as Obama said, make us $1 trillion richer. A trillion divided by 17.3 million is 58,000. So we've got a ton of new people and $58,000 ahead to pay them, educate their children, attend to their health care, and supply them with Social Security. I say we'll be lucky to break even there. The USA has all the people we need. With half the people we have now, we won a tremendous war, built the interstate highway system, put men on the moon, and dazzled the world with our popular culture. Income for working and middle-class Americans has been flatlining since the early 1970s, just when the 1965 Immigration Act began to kick in. Don't Americans get it? We're being displaced and replaced. The elites are electing another people. I'm sick of these treason lobbies, the billionaire businessmen who prefer cheap foreigners to their own countrymen, the race lobbies rubbing their hands with glee as the founding population of this country dwindles to a minority, the sneering politicians telling us how lazy and useless we are, how we need to be enriched with the fabulous diversity of third world sinkholes like Haiti and Pakistan. It's nation killing. Yes, it's treason. Ted Cruz and his insurgents would have served their country better if, instead of betting the house on defunding Obamacare, they'd saved their chips for the more important fight, the fight to preserve the American middle class against the crushing forces applied from above and below of economic disempowerment and demographic replacement. Microaggression of the week was inflicted by US Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. The court was hearing oral arguments in an affirmative action case. Back in 2006, in a ballot measure called Proposal 2, the voters of Michigan approved a ban on all race-based, quote, preferential treatment, end quote, in education. Not much of a surprise there. Race preferences in college admission are widely disliked. A Gallup poll in July found that 67% of Americans believe that college applicants should be admitted solely on merit, even if that results in few minorities being admitted. Only 28% believe a college applicant's race should be taken into account to promote diversity on campuses. Well, that's because 67% of us are gap-toothed hillbillies just itching to burn a cross on someone's lawn. Our wise elites swung into action to enlighten us. In 2011, after a district court had upheld the proposal, the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals declared it unconstitutional. Banning race preferences is unconstitutional, said the appeals court, because it, quote, undermines the Equal Protection Clause's guarantee that all citizens ought to have equal access to the tools of political change, end quote. Got that? Banning preferential treatment undermines the Equal Protection Clause. That's 21st century jurisprudence. Well, the hillbillies counter-appealed, and here we were Tuesday with oral arguments before the Supremes, including the aforementioned Associate Justice Scalia. A lawyer named Shanta Driver, representing the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action, Integration and Immigrant Rights and Fight for Equality by Any Means Necessary, that's who she's representing. Don't blame me, I'm just the messenger here. This CDAAIIRFEBAMN lawyer at one point told the court that the Michigan proposal is unconstitutional because it fails, quote, to protect minority rights against a white majority. That was when Justice Scalia committed his microaggression. Quote from him. My goodness, I thought we've held that the 14th Amendment protects all races. I mean, that was the argument in the early years that it protected the blacks. But I thought we rejected that. End quote. Coloured people all over the nation howled in anguish and fell to the ground writhing with pain on hearing of Justice Scalia's vile and monstrous calumny. Professional black guy Nick Chiles shuddered that, quote, if words mean anything, one would have to believe that a Supreme Court justice using the expression the blacks to refer to African Americans does not bode well for African Americans seeking unbiased treatment from the court. End quote. That was on a website named Atlanta Black Star. Also microaggressed was the Reverend Al Sharpton Jr., much loved elder statesman, tribune of the people, healer, nurturer, champion of social harmony and peace, presidential confidant, and intellectual powerhouse of the civil rights movement. Before anyone even had a chance to axe his opinion, the Reverend Sharpton offered it.
The blacks? Talking about the blacks, is this the kind of tone-deaf language we should be hearing at the nation's highest court in the year of 2013?
Let the healing begin. And in future, Justice Scalia, try to be more tactful. Instead of something as coarse as the blacks, try saying you people. Okay, I'm getting a little heated here. To cool down, let's see what's happening abroad. Here's a nice low-temperature country. Russia. What's going on there? Multiculturalism, that's what. And Russians don't care for it. The word for black in the Russian language is Chernyi. When a Russian Supreme Court justice wants to say the blacks, he says Chernyi. Everybody knows what he's talking about. He's talking about Chechens, Azerbaijanis, Avars, Ingush, and all the innumerable other ethnicities living in the Caucasus Mountains. Yes, to a Russian, Caucasians are black. I tell you, it's a strange country they've got there. Well, a great many of these Caucasian ethnicities, including all the ones I just named, are Muslims. So I guess, from the Russian point of view, they're black Muslims. Louis Farrakhan, call your office. These Muslims of the Caucasus have been immigrating into Russia's big cities, and, like Muslims elsewhere in Europe, they impose themselves on the local people. There are around 2 million of them in Moscow, and on high holy days they impose themselves on the Muscovites by praying in the streets en masse, halting all traffic. Russians are getting fed up with it, and they're not much into white racial guilt about their blacks. October 13th, the English language Russian network RT.com reported a serious riot in a southern district of Moscow. The occasion of the riot was that a 25-year-old Russian man named Yegor Shcherbakov had been stabbed to death by one of the blacks. Several hundred rioters looted a warehouse that employs these illegals and a mall frequented by them. Quote from the RT.com report, quote, "Ethnic tensions in Moscow have been high on politicians' agenda in recent months, with the issue of illegal immigration a key theme in the city's mayoral election last month. Unofficial estimates put the number of illegal immigrants in Russia at 10 to 12 million. End quote. 10 to 12 million, eh? Well, that sounds familiar. Here's the punchline. The following day, October 14th, police raided the warehouse and arrested 1,200 illegal alien workers. Russian TV showed the arrested illegals lined up against a fence with their hands tied behind their backs. Imagine that! In the USA, if citizens rioted against a warehouse employing illegal aliens, the rioters would all be charged with hate crimes and the illegals would be given college scholarships and EBT cards. Says the BBC report, quote, "The police clearly want to convince Muscovites they take the grievances of local residents seriously and will crack down hard on illegal migrant workers," end quote. Imagine that! The authorities taking the side of citizens against illegal aliens. Just as I told you, Russia's a strange country. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Those of us who believe that pop culture is filth had our spirits momentarily lifted this week at hearing the news that a small town in Louisiana had banned twerking. Alas, it was a false report. The website issuing the report, eonline.com, is a spoof outlet like The Onion. If Radio Derb is in tune with popular feeling, which I don't think can be doubted, any town that did ban twerking would see property values soar. Likewise, with any town that banned face piercings, tattoos on females, neck beards, burkas, muffin tops, Oprah Winfrey movers, or persons named Kardashian. Item, back to the Reverend Dr. Al Sharpton Jr. for a moment. His flock is getting restive. Quote from the New York Daily News, October 14th, quote, four upstart clergymen have invited more than 100 churches to knock Reverend Al Sharpton off his Harlem political throne. Speak Out, Say It Loud, that's the name of an organisation, headquartered at Mount Nebo Baptist Church on Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard, is a new coalition of black ministers determined to create a unified African-American power base with citywide clout. Mount Nebo pastor Johnny Green, age 51, said Sharpton has neglected black New York while pursuing national fame and acclaim. While Sharpton is jet-setting around the country, people are going to our churches saying they don't have money to eat, the Dallas native said. I didn't read that right, did I? Let me try again. While Sharpton is jet-setting around the country, people are going to our churches saying they don't have money to eat, the Dallas native said. That's better. Say it ain't so. Reverend Al is neglecting the blacks. Hard to believe. As for folk in Harlem not having money to eat, I'll just observe that I've been in Harlem. And whatever problems they have up there, malnutrition sure isn't on the list. Item. Finally, Puerto Rican boxer Orlando Cruz was defeated last Saturday in his bid for the featherweight title after being knocked down in round 7 by his opponent, a different Orlando, Orlando Salido from Mexico. All this happened, no, not in Orlando, Florida, but in Las Vegas, Nevada. Why is this newsworthy? Because Orlando Cruz, that's the defeated Orlando, recently declared himself a homosexual and had ambitions to be the first openly homosexual boxing champion in any weight class. Except possibly the light in the loafers class. The CBS News report ignited a firestorm of extremely tasteless jokes by reporting that Cruz, after being knocked down, was, quote, on his knees and couldn't get up as he was counted out. Oh dear. I refuse to join in the unseemly snickering here. Mr. Cruz has my total sympathy. I can just imagine how much he wanted that purse. That's it, ladies and gents. Having given you a taste of old Russia there, let's summon up the Red Army Choir to sing us out. Here they are with Polyushka Polye, which is something to do with soldiers riding across a field. This I know because the word Polye shows up in my favourite Russian proverb. Zhizn prajit, ni polye periti. That means to go through life is not to walk across a field. And you'd better believe it's true. More from Radio Derb next week. Take it away, lads. Thank you.
Christmas, so we're up.